So we started discussing some of the kashrut of different items of food, different ingredients. And so now we're going to be talking about some more modern kashrut controversies. Talking about three things specifically. We're going to be talking about gelatin. We're talking about shellac and other waxes and coatings. We're talking about honey. And as we've said many times before, you know, over the last few decades and centuries, really, the food industry has advanced in such a way that there are all sorts of questions which we never had before. You know, once upon a time it was very, very simple, the ingredients which went in. Now there are all sorts of things. And one of the things to know about the modern food industry is that not all of the ingredients which go into, or the additives and different things which go into food are actually food, or are actually necessarily edible things. And that's going to have vaster implications for us in terms of the kashrut. So let's begin. I'll share the screen with everyone. For those who don't have the book. Yeah, so we're starting off tonight just talking about honey, and there's going to be some principles that come out of this. Very, very important for the rest of the for the rest of the discussions as well. The Gemara over here in Masechet Bechorot, source number 23. You can see it for those who have the book, page 92. But the very important principle in terms of kashrut. The Gemara asks, you know, how is it, or where do we know from, why should it be that honey is kosher? Because we have a principle. We don't have it quoted over here. But we have a principle, yotzei me'atameh tameh, yotzei me'atameh tohor, meaning anything which derives from a kosher species would or could be kosher, but anything which derives from a non-kosher species would not be kosher. That's the reason why if you have milk or eggs, things like that, which come from a non-kosher animal, those would be non-kosher. And the Hava Amina, the first thought of the Gemara, is that honey should be the same. Honey comes from bees. Therefore, we'd expect that it would not be kosher. So the Gemara says, it actually brings two opinions. It says, Mipnei mamru dvash dvorim mutar. See, well, it's significant that it's specifically bees honey. Why is it that it is allowed? Answers the Gemara, answer number one, and this is the opinion of the Tanakama. Mipnei shemachnisot oto legufan, ve'ein mematsot oto migufan. I.e. that the bees, they take the nectar and they bring it into their body, but it's not excreted from their body. I.e. there's a chemical change, there's a change which is undergone where the bees, you know, take the nectar, do whatever they do, and then it's secreted again. But it's not something which inherently came from the bees. It came from the flowers. And therefore it would not fit into this category of yotzei me'atameh, because it didn't, strictly speaking, come out of the non-kosher species to begin with, and that's why it would be kosher. That's the opinion of Tanakama. Rabbi Yaakov answers differently. He says, no, he learns it from Pasuk. He learns it out as a gzerat ha-katov. Rabbi Yaakov omer, ach et ze tochlu mikol shel tzahov. Learn from the Pasuk, which says, only this you'll eat from all the winged creatures, from the and from the fact that it says you can't eat a non-kosher winged creature, all sorts of things we spoke about a number of months ago. But this you can eat from that ach, and therefore from this pasuk he learns out that there is an exclusion, and the exclusion, like Mark goes on and explains how it learns it, but it says that zeh dvash dvorim, this is the honey of bees. So essentially, yeah, we have two different opinions in the Gemara. How do we learn out regarding honey? Is it because it's a gzerat hakatov? Is it because there's a difference that there's not something which begins, you know, in is a secretion from the bees necessarily, and that's why it would be kosher. And we'll see based on those two reasons moving further along, different substances that we have, whether this would this would apply or not. The Gemara then continues and says that's regarding honey of bees, which everybody agrees is kosher. You know, and pure bees honey, that would be kosher according to all opinions. The Gemara then says, what about different types of honey of the gizin and sirin? I'm not sure exactly what they are, but different kinds of species, maybe some sort of grasshopper, some sort of wasp. Would you say that the honey which comes from these would be kosher as well? And the Gemara says no. It says that the gzerat hakatov is only regarding honey of bees. And it says, because when you talk about bees honey, it sounds strange that we're saying bees honey. You know, we say honey, that's what it is. And it doesn't have the name of the honey. It doesn't have the name of the non-kosher species included together with it. However, when it comes to this dvash gizin or dvash tzirin, whatever it is, that is associated together with the name of that particular species, non-kosher species, which it came from, and therefore that would not be kosher. Shulchan Aruch brings us the halacha that honey is kosher. He doesn't say according to which reason it is necessarily. But it's an important point here as well that sometimes when the honey has got mixed in with it, you know, maybe the bee's legs or different parts of different body parts of the bees themselves, nonetheless, he says that it would still be kosher. It's dvash dvorim mutar, afal pi shegufei dvorim olavim, but even though there is a, you know, some of the bees' remnants are mixed inside. However, it says shemaflishin advash mehen machaminu matachinu tam mehen mutar shum davei noten tam nifka. I.e., when the honey is taken and it's prepared and it's heated up, and it's all sort of cooked together, it would still be allowed because it's noten tam nifgam. As we've discussed many times, this principle that it does not enhance the flavor, but really detracts from the flavor or contaminates, blemishes, whatever word you want to say. That's why it would be allowed. But that is b'di'evad, by the way. The Shach points out, the Shach repeats that as well. We have here, you'll see in source number 26 from Rav Melamed, another post can point this out as well, that the honey needs to be strained. Right? First of all, he says, dvolaim, the beekeepers, l'chim nesanen et hadvash. First of all, the honey has to be strained and get rid of whatever you can of all those body parts of the actual bees that are mixed in. And he says, "La'chal sinon advash kashen." After following strain, the honey is permitted. If there's something that's left, it would be batel, etc., for the reasons that we have discussed. That's in terms of honey, and honey itself, when there's no additives or anything added in, is relatively straightforward. There are a few other things, other honey sort of or bee derivatives, where it gets a little bit more complicated. One of them is royal jelly. You know, this is something which is often used as a marketed or used as a dietary supplement. It is a sort of a secretion that comes from the bees, used by the queen bee. You can see over here on footnote number 23, there's a little bit of explanation about it, exactly what it is. And the question is as well would be kosher, and that would again depend on the two reasons that we saw in the Gemara regarding honey. You said, yeah, just in the box, it says, according to the reason that honey is not an excretion produced by the bee, but merely expelling the nectar ingested in a different form, well, over here, there's royal jelly, that would not be the case, and then it would be forbidden. But if that would be according to the first reason. If it's according to the second reason, we said that it's based on a pasuk, well, maybe this would be included, you know, as part of everything that comes from a bee, and that would be included as well. So the Tzitz Eliezer discusses it. He discusses these two factors. His conclusion is to be lenient. He says, very, very lengthy tshuva about it. He says, mutar lefi aniyut dati lakachat tshufa zot shom mazon malachut. In English called royal jelly, and in Hebrew it's called queen food. But he says somebody wants to take it for medicinal purposes, that would be allowed. Not all the poskim are so keen on it. There are many poskim that are more stringent. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is not so convinced that it should be allowed. He writes about it. He says at the end of the day, if it's less than a kazayit and it's small and it's mixed in and it's somebody who's sick, it's, you know, somebody who's, we discussed last week about medicines. Spoke about the difference between medicines and just taking, you know, health supplements. And we said there's certain things, even somebody who's considered sick might be allowed to take a medicine. But somebody who's healthy and wants to take a supplement, you know, there might be a kasher of questions over there. Yeah, too, as well. He says if it's mixed in and if it's less than a share and it's somebody who's sick, then there might be room to rely on it. But he's otherwise it would be stringent. That's Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. The OU, there's a Pesach of Rav Shechta, also based on Rav Shlomo Zalman, are even more stringent. And they say over here, some have argued the royal jelly should be permitted, because it's honey-like and presumably included in the spiritual scriptural exception as well. But this argument is difficult to support. As they say, it's a glandular secretion and it differs in appearance, taste, and function from honey. Therefore, should not be included. It's a different food. As well, just another interesting point they mentioned over here, others have contended that royal jelly is not considered fit for human consumption, as it's very bitter and therefore not subject to any prohibition, as we discussed Lent last week. This contention, however, is erroneous, for while royal jelly is indeed somewhat tart and bitter, by no means inedible, even in its pure raw state, and this was confirmed by our Gentile tester. We've spoken before, you know, when it comes to mixtures, nowadays we go by the measure of 60 to 1, but going back to the Gemara, it talks about how you could ask a non-Jew to come and taste the food, you know, the meat and milk that had been mixed together, to know if it's tasted, if you could still taste it. And we see over here the OU, at least in terms of this, we're relying on that principle. But their psak over here is that it's not kosher and cannot be regarded in the same light as honey. We've seen there's a machloket amongst the poskim. If anybody, you know, has this as a medicinal supplements and they think they need to take it, then they should ask the question. But you can see those are some of the opinions. There's a bit of a discussion about beeswax, but we'll skip that and we'll go into the second topic for this evening, which is shellac, confectioner's glaze, and waxed fruits and vegetables. And this is, as I said, you know, there's all sorts of things in the modern food industry which are ingredients which are not necessarily not necessarily food, but they're added for to give color, to give not to give flavors usually is would be food, but to give color, to make the appearance look better, to stabilize all sorts of things. You know, one of the things you can see from here as well, just how careful you have to be. You know, people often ask, you know, what could be non-kosher about X? So fruit and vegetables is a classic case in point. Right? People say, what could be non-kosher about fruits, about vegetables? So aside from the question of insects, which we discussed previously, leaving aside, you know, produce of Eretz Yisrael, which needs a trumot and masrot, and there could be questions of orla and things like that, which we'll discuss in some of the upcoming shirim. Just ordinary, you know, tomatoes, cucumbers, apples, oranges, etc. You might think it seemed innocent enough. The problem is that many times, you know, when you go into the supermarket and you get these, you know, get your apples or your fruits and you pick them up and they look so shiny, or well, they don't look like that naturally. They're coated in all sorts of waxes and shellac and different ingredients to make them look more appealing. And there, all sorts of things can be used in these waxes. One of them is what's known as either shellac or confectioner's glaze. And there's a little description over here. That shellac is a resin that is secreted by a small beetle found in India, known as Haria lacca, or the lac bug. We'll see as well the fact that the name shellac includes that name of the bug could be significant. And what exactly is it? It says these insects ingest sap from trees and then secrete it in the form of shellac, which attaches itself to the branches and hardens, then transformed through a complex process into confectioner's glaze, used to give rise to shine, including many types of candies and fruits and vegetables. This is also used very commonly in non-food products, but it's also used in foods as well, in fruits and vegetables. And here the question is, would that be kosher or not? By the way, I mentioned controversy, so we're going to get into our first controversy tonight. Thing to be aware of in terms of these different questions and you know, these new questions of food is that different kashrut agencies will have different rules, and in different countries there'll be different rules. It doesn't mean you know, necessarily that they're one country is frumer than another. We'll see now, this will be one example, gelatin will be another, where, you know, in Israel something might be accepted and in America or England it may not be accepted as kosher, or vice versa. Doesn't mean that one is better than the other, or one is, you know, less stringent or necessarily. But there are different customs and different poskim and different places go about different poskim, and we'll see that now. Now, what you've probably noticed from this description of shellac, that in a sense, there's a certain similarity to what we discussed regarding honey. It's going to be significant, right? We might say, and it's going to be the stringent position, would say, we said anything which comes out from a non-kosher species is considered non-kosher. And therefore, this is a secretion that comes from insects. Insects, we know, are very much not kosher. We've discussed at length in the past. Therefore, the shirak would not be kosher, and any fruit or vegetables, which were or sweets, which were coated in it, would also be non-kosher. However, just reading the description again, so these insects ingest sap from trees and then secrete it in the form of shirak. So maybe there's room over there to compare to exactly what the Tanakhama told us regarding honey. Now, regarding honey, he told us that it's not that the bee ingests the nectar and then secretes honey. Maybe it's the same thing. So Rav Moshe Feinstein discusses this topic, and his conclusion is that it would be permitted, and he has four different reasons why. And it's possible that maybe each of these four reasons in and of themselves wouldn't suffice, but all four together, there's enough room to be lenient. So let's see what Rav Moshe Feinstein has to say about it. He says, Hinei b'dvar shelak, sheba mitolaim, ayonkim misraf ilan, yadua ve'eno mitmatzim migufo, so first he gives a description as to exactly what it is, how these insects, they suck the sap from the trees. Again, that's the same language the Gemara uses regarding honey. And then it's meaning it doesn't get produced in the insect's body, but it's then secreted. It hardens like wood. And then he discusses the process afterwards it gets the... eventually it gets mixed with alcohol, and then it's coated on different foods. So he says, Hinei, v'day lamatirin dvash tzir'in b'yorodea, gamze mutar mishum d'talinan ledidu, kol kai gavna shem kedvash dvorim she'en matzot ato migufa. So we mentioned the Gemara, it didn't go into this in great detail, but we mentioned regarding honey, that the Gemara spoke about first bees' honey, which is ordinary honey, and then it spoke about this dvash tzil'in and other things. And really, that would be a machloket between the two opinions that we saw, whether that would be allowed or not. We saw that those who go by the gzerata katuv, would include only honey itself from bees, but not the others, which are something else. That would be the second opinion of Rabbi Yaakov. But according to the Tanakhama, it says that it's based on the fact that it doesn't originate inside the insect's body, that would be okay. So says Rav Moshe Feinstein over here, he says those would permit it, either according to the first bin of the Tanakhama, over here, it would be permitted as well. In the same way that honey doesn't originate inside the bee, but it comes from the nectar, which is in the flowers, so too over here, it begins with the sap, which is in the trees. And that would be a reason to permit. However, that would only be a reason according to Tanakhama. So that's reason number one. Reason number two, he says, even according to the second opinion, and it's based on the Pasuk, we could allow the shirak as well. Why? And he explains, he says, since when the Gemara came along and said we learn from a Pasuk that we can allow honey as well, that was a chiddush. We say that was only concerning honey, which is called honey, not honey which is called, honey of tirin or of wasps or whatever it is. It doesn't have the name of the non-kosher insect associated with it. Because over here, it's called shelak. Shelak, saying shelak is like honey. And therefore, you might say that it's also included in that gzera takat. Thirdly, he says, as I said, each of these reasons may not stand alone. We'll bring them all together. So the third thing is that this shirak, it hardens like wood. And again, this is, we're going to get to gelatine soon. This expression of hardening like wood is going to be extremely significant. But it hardens like wood when it comes out into the air, and it is inedible at that point. Even though through all sorts of processes it turns into a food or a food component, in other words, he quotes a Gemara in Tmura, which talks about the case of we have an egg that comes from a nevela or a trefa hen, where i.e. the chicken, the mother hen, which would not be kosher, not because a hen is not a kosher species, but because it's a nevela or a trefa, would not be kosher, and therefore the egg by default would not be kosher. However, and the Gemara over there says that it goes through a process where the egg becomes sour, and then the chick which is born from that egg, it goes through a process whereby the chick before it's created, it becomes sour and it's like mere dust, and then it's allowed. I.e., it goes through a stage where it is inedible. So even though the original thing may have had reasons to forbid it, once it goes through a stage where it's inedible, and we'll discuss this more when we get to gelatin as well, that would be a reason to permit it. That's number three. And number four, it says even if you're going to reject all of these and you're going to say still it should be forbidden, it says, this is something which actually doesn't have a taste and you can't taste it. As I said, this is, these are new questions which come up when we add components to food, which are not actually naturally food components. It's just, it's wax to make it look better. So therefore it is nitpatel barova alcohol, shemitarevbo, when it's mixed in with all the alcohol, and therefore it's nullified in the majority. And for those four reasons together, he says that this is permitted. Minchat Yitzchak also rules leniently over here, which in itself is quite a chiddush. But he does acknowledge that he's not so familiar with the production method, and he says not to rely on him halacha lemaisa. That's Rav Moshe Feinstein, and based on this, many of the what I was alluding to earlier, many of the kashrut agencies, certainly in North America, the OU and Starkey and many of those would allow this. In Israel, it's a bit more contentious. None of the Mahadran Hechshers will allow shellac. This is based on the Pesach of Rabbi Eliashiv, who essentially rejected all of the reasons that Rav Moshe Feinstein said. And let's see here if there's a summary. Yeah, so there's a summary here of we're going through all four reasons why we may not rely on it. First of all, we said that if we go like the Tanakama, that it's shellac is similar to honey and that it doesn't originate from inside the animal, inside the insect. So he says it could be. Maybe the comparison is not accurate. But shellac is a complex product. The lac definitely contributes to its production in a way that is different from the way a bee makes honey. It may even be that Tanakam will consider shellac to be non-kosher. We'd be certain. Number one. Number two, what he said to do with the Gzerat HaKatov and to do with the way that of what it's called, that it doesn't have the name of the creature in it. Well, we see that actually the word shellac comes from the name of the lack as well, and it may be difficult to expand the Gzerat HaKatov to include that as well. And the third point, where he considered it to a chick which comes from a non-kosher egg, there was specifically when it went through a process of deterioration. But when it comes to shellac, it doesn't actually deteriorate during this process. And finally, in terms of the question of bittul, this again to do with the production method is that after the shellac is applied, the alcohol itself is evaporated, and the final product is something like 80% shellac, and therefore could not allow for bittul. So this is a big machloket, as I said, and the bottom line is that in Israel, certainly the Mahadran Hechshers would not allow this. Many of the Hechsherim in America and other places would allow. What that means would allow, though, is that if there is fruit, apples or whatever it is, they would allow those to be used. But if you have a Hechsher, the OU has written on their website, where the Hechsher is given to fruit and vegetables, that means that it doesn't have any waxes that have got questionable or a non-kosher non-kosher ingredients. Now, the truth is there are other waxes that are used, different materials, and you can see, for those who have the books, again, there's a number of links of different websites that go through some of the waxes and different things that are used. At the end of the day, this is from Rav David Haber from Starkey, I think, and he writes here that the overwhelming evidence points to the fact that the raw materials, both major minor were kosher power, that the majority of actually which are used are not problematic at the end of the day. And therefore, he says, based on current manufacturing procedures, one therefore need not be concerned with vegetable, petroleum, and shellac-based waxes applied to fruits and vegetables. Of course, if somebody knows that there's wax and you're able to ascertain and there's a problem, so that's something different. But that's more or less in terms of that. And finally, we get to the third, the real controversy, which has been over the last 100 years or so, regarding gelatine. And this is a big dispute. It has been over the years between different poskim and quite a lot to get through here, but we'll just try and give an overview of the subject. Now, gelatine, first of all, what is it? You can see over here, brief description. Gelatine is usually produced from either the bones or skins of cattle, pigs, and fish. And there's obviously going to be a big difference whether it's coming from cattle or pigs or fish. It's also going to be a big difference whether it's coming from bones or skin. We'll get into that in a minute. But essentially what happens is that the bones are crushed into a thin powder, then mixed with hot water, which causes hydrolysis to occur and allows the gelatine to be extracted. And it comes from a material which is in the skin and the hides and bones of the animal, a chemical, collagen, which is then extracted. It then congeals after the mixture is cooled, and it's then used in a lot of different foods as a binding agent. So a number of different issues here as to whether this would be kosher or not. Obviously, the question we're talking about, if it comes from a non-kosher animal, it comes from pig, for example, would it be could the gelatine itself be kosher? Or if it comes from a kosher species, but a novella or a trefa that hasn't been slaughtered in the proper way, and this is the majority of gelatine in the industry is going to come from these kind of things. Also, if it comes from a kosher source, would it be meaty or parav? Is another question that's raised. And a couple of weeks ago, I think somebody asked, and fish gelatine, which is also used today, quite common. If you have something which with fish gelatine, could that be eaten with milk, meat as well? So we mentioned that a couple of weeks ago. But in terms of the gelatine itself, whether it would be kosher. So the first thing is, we said the source is either from bones or from skin. So let's talk about bones for a little bit first. We mentioned already when it came to honey that you could have a situation of honey which has the bees legs inside, things like that, and it would still be allowed. So we mentioned that it was there, that there was a case of Noten Tam Lifgam. There is a Tosfot, this Rabbeinu Tam says, very interesting language. He says that the reason the legs of the bees would still be allowed is because they're just bones. Just bones, and it's not any actual flesh or anything like that, and therefore it would be allowed. And we know that there are certain parts of the animal which are not considered, which are not meat or which are not considered edible, which could be permitted. Certainly from a Torah level, bones and hooves and things like that are not considered meat or not considered, would not be problematic, but however, they would still be a problem on the Rabbanan level. That's what the Rambam writes. Rambam writes that it would still be a problem with Midrabanan. Tosfot, Rabbeinu Tam, as I've just mentioned, talking about bees and talking about legs, says that bones would be permitted for consumption. So you have a bit of a contradiction in terms as to whether bones are permitted for consumption completely or they're forbidden Midrabanan. If we were to say that they were allowed, so then the gelatine would raise no question if it's coming from bones. And Rav Yechezkel Avramsky and Rav Chaim Ozer were two great poskim from the last generation. And Rav Yechezkel Avramsky was the Yav Beit Din in London. They really say that essentially there's actually no machloket between the Rambam and Tosfot in terms of this, the bones. But they're talking about two different types of bones. Talking about hard bones versus soft bones. Hard bones which are completely inedible. Which you can't taste. There would be no problem there, no prohibition. If it's the soft bones, which you can still eat and you can still taste somewhat, then that would be a question. That's the way Rav Chaim Ozer explains it. not everybody accepts that distinction. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Aaron Kotler, they reject that completely, and say the bones would still be permitted and still be prohibited in the first instance. And the truth is that nowadays this isn't really so relevant because it's usually made from either the soft bones or from the soft hides and skins, and that's where the gelatin is made from, and therefore we can't really rely on that. You can see over here, it goes Moshe, this is from Moshe Feinstein, he's talking about the gelatin. And I said, if it comes from skins and of non-kosher animals, of neverot and trefot, that would be forbidden. He says, even though it's going to be a rabbinic prohibition to eat them, it's still forbidden. And that's what the Rambam writes, and therefore the bones themselves are forbidden, therefore the gelatin themselves would also be forbidden. That's what Moshe Feinstein said. That's our starting point. So that's one potential leniency gone. However, the great leniency which those who permit gelatin is based on something else, what's called panim chadashot. By the way, I'll mention this controversy and this question of gelatin comes up and it's brought as a very relevant argument, not just in terms of gelatin itself. Something we've mentioned a number of times here, the lab-grown meat. Those who were, a couple of weeks ago, we had the professor from the Technion talking to us about how it's made. So one of the really relevant sugya which people have been discussing, if we have time at the end, maybe we'll get back to it, as to whether it is comparable or not, is to do with this gelatin as well. But Rav Avadia Yosef, together with a number of Rav Chaim Ozer as well, was lenient in this regard, also the Tzitz Eliezer, has a leniency for gelatin based on something else. And it's based on this idea of what's called panim chadashot, which literally means new faces, but it means a new substance. There is a Rosh in Masechet Brachot, talks about Bezer Rabbeinu Yona, who talks about the mask. Mask is a certain some type of chemical. It's used as a certain type of perfume, which comes from some type of, it's a glandular secretion, which comes from some animals. It was used in food processing as well. But Rabbeinu Yona talks about it, and he says that it started off as blood. It's the source in the blood of the animal. And therefore, you would think that it would be non-kosher. However, he says that by the time it turns into mask, it's something completely different. Right? It's a completely different chemical makeup. It's a completely new substance. What he calls panim chadashot ba'olakan. And based on that, he allows it. But no, that in itself is a machloket amongst the Rishonim, as whether that's allowed or not. But Rav Avadia Yosef and the other Rabbanim I mentioned as well take this idea of panim chadashot and they extend it to this question of gelatin as well. See here in Shut Yabia Omer, he says, Lechora yesh lausif od nimuk latir, why would we allow it? Ve'ilu b'talich ha'tzor shel ha'gelatin, min ha'ov ha'tzamot, when the gelatin is being produced from the skin and from the bones, לאחר שנתיישבו היתה, שנתיישבו היתה בשמש, במשך כמה חודשים, they are dried out very well for a number of months. Afterwards, מעבים בהם מלחים כימיים, they are added, all sorts of chemicals are added, תוכנים אותם עדיין היתה, they are ground up very, very finely, until it becomes a powder, and becomes something completely different. Gelatin itself bears no resemblance to an animal skin or an animal bone, whatever it was in the first place. And therefore he says, פנים חדשות באו לכאנים, it's a new entity, it is a new substance, and therefore he says that it would be allowed. So too, he says the Tzitz Eliezer and Rav Chaim Ozer were willing to accept this to accept this approach, and therefore to allow gelatin. Rav Avramsky, very interestingly, he rejects this argument, and he says, you're saying panim chadashot, you're saying it's become something new. Well, how exactly did it become something new? All that's happened is that you've separated the original substance, you've separated the chemical substance that was in the bones all the time. You've now sort of extracted that and you've created something else. But it's not that, you've done magic and you've changed. It says, the gelatin, it's the same material that was in the bones in the first place. וכל האמצעים הכימיים שמשתמשים בהם בתעשיית הג'לטין אינם באים אלא להפריד שאר חומרים. So this is all a chemical reaction which is done over here to separate the different substances. And therefore he says, ממילא אין כאן מקום למעשה ומתן ביתר ג'לטין הנעשה מעצמות נבלות רפות על פי דברי רבני יונה. Therefore he says, according to this reason, would not be willing to accept it as a leniency. He does look at other reasons, but that's just in terms of the panim chalashot argument. I'll just mention over here what I alluded to before. We talked about the abgra meat. Sorry, Karin is just mentioning it. But so some have said that, again, just for those who aren't familiar, you know, the case in point is where you take cells from an animal, you take stem cells from the muscle tissue or wherever it is, and those are grown in a lab. Those are added with a growth medium and nutrients, and they multiply, and then essentially you, under lab conditions, recreate the muscle tissue and recreate a piece of meat. The question is this piece of meat going to be meat or parve? Is it going to be kosher if it comes from a non-kosher animal, or kosher if it comes from a living animal, etc.? For those that are interested in volume 4 of Tzorba, there's an essay about it. But one of the arguments that's been put forward is this, you know, based on this gelatin idea and based on this panim chadashot argument. Those want to say, you know, you're taking something, you're taking one substance, and you're turning it into something else. You're taking a stem cell, whatever it is, and you're turning it into a steak or a burger. The counter argument to that is exactly what we've just said. Well, you're not turning it into something else. You are taking what it was and what it always was going to be. You've just, you know, separated the cells, and then you are growing them back. That's one line of thinking which has been discussed. There's another one which is connected to the next leniency, possibly, in terms of the gelatin itself. So just to recap what we've said until now, we've said we can't rely on the fact that the bones are inedible because it comes from bones or from skin, which is edible. Ravavadia, those that are lenient, the main leniency was the idea that it's panim chadashot, that it's changed its substance, it's changed its form. We saw that Rav Ramsky rejected that as well. But there's a third argument to say that, again, we know something which becomes completely inedible, something which is not edible, may be, you know, permitted for consumption. The original non-kosher states that it had would be lost. And when the gelatin is produced, so this certainly, and everybody would agree, that through the chemical process and through the manufacture, it undergoes a stage where it becomes inedible. We mentioned before this expression of, you know, kasher ka'etz, where it's hard like wood. But later on, it then becomes edible again. At the end of the day, the gelatin is in your food, which you eat, and it's very much edible. So the question is, we know that something which goes from, something which doesn't give a taste, something which is inedible, would be permitted for consumption. What happens if you have something which started off edible, went through a stage where it was not edible, and then at the end became edible again? Would we say that we, you know, in the middle, it's there's sort of a similar nuance here to the Panim Chalashot argument, but slightly different. Would we say that stage in the middle really uprooted the status completely? And we retain with that states in the middle where it was inedible, or do we say no? Once it's made in such a way that you can eat it again, that it once more becomes forbidden. And as you can imagine, this is a huge argument. The Ramah and the Shach will talk about it a little bit. It's a huge argument. Some of the poskim I mentioned before, Rav Chaim Oizer, Rav Frank, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, held that in such a case it would be permitted. Others, like notably Rav Aaron Kotler, did not accept that argument, and he said that it would be would still be forbidden. Also mentions another couple of points that first of all, what we call achshavei, that even if something which is objectively, you know, has lost its status of being considered edible, but once you pick it up and you decide and you show that you want to eat it, so then it becomes subjectively significant, and that would no longer be that leniency would no longer apply. He also says something else. Um, Because even if it went through a stage where it was not edible, when it was all softened, and even afterwards, even if afterwards he says it, in and of itself it may not be, you know, edible, he says kevan she'omdim letakena ma'achal halizek yisur, since it's something which is designed to prepare the food, it's like yeast. The Gemara talks about yeast, which in and of itself is not edible, but it's something which is there, which serves a purpose in facilitating the food, you know, causing the bread to rise and being very significant. It's similar to the idea of what we call a davar ma'amid, which is something which renders the shape or the taste or the substance of the food, and that wouldn't, even if that itself was not edible, but it would still, it would be significant, and it would, if it's forbidden, would forbid the entire mixture. So you can see Rav Aaron Carter is probably one of the most stringent voices in terms of this question of gelatin, but he rejects all the leniencies, and he would not allow it. So just to finish that point, going back to the meat that I was talking about before, this is the other argument that's been advanced to say in terms of the comparison to gelatin, to say there may be, just like those, some of those lenient voices said, that the gelatin itself goes through a stage where it is inedible, even though at the end of the day it becomes edible. We saw Ravar and Kotler rejected that, but others accepted that argument. I just want to say so too. You know, you take the cells, that they go through a process where you can't eat them, and at the end of the day, they become a steak or a hamburger or whatever it is, and you can eat them, but therefore it would be allowed. Others have argued, and personally, I don't think this comparison is so accurate, because over there, the point is not that the cells undergo a chemical change; they are inherently, you know, can't be eaten. It's just they're just very small. They're microscopic when you take them off, but it's not that there's anything, you know, they've undergone a substantial change that makes them, you know, unfit for consumption. Inherently, they would still be fit for consumption. And that's what Yaakov Ariel has argued and others. So still not quite a one-to-one comparison. But that's what we've seen. We've seen the basic opinions regarding gelatin. As I said, the main voices to say yes, that it was allowed were Rav Avadia Yosef, Tzitzi Eliezer, and Rav Chaim Moser, based on primarily the Panim Chalashot argument. Others are Moshe Feinstein, Rav Aaron Kotler, and again, different levels of, you know, whether it's definitely forbidden, Doraita, Dorabanan, but they said that it would be, they said that it would be forbidden. And nowadays, I think the majority of Kashrut agencies, both in Israel and abroad, certainly the Mahadran Hashem would not allow gelatin from non-kosher animals. Often today they would use fish gelatin, which would be okay. In Israel, the chief rabbinate does not allow the use of gelatin from non-kosher animals as well. So anything that has the stamp of the rabbanut would not have this question. The final place where gelatin does come up is in terms of medicines, which we spoke last week. Some of the gel caps, some of the coatings of the capsules and things like that do contain gelatin. Again, medicine over there, it's not edible at all. It's not meant to be, you know, consumed as food. A lot of the stringencies which we discuss now, you know, would not necessarily apply for somebody who's sick or somebody who's taking medicine. And the post came to say that if there's something which is completely permitted, as we discussed last week, which doesn't have the question, so that's better. But nonetheless, many would allow to take these medicines and gel caps, etc. I think we'll end it over there. Next week, stay tuned. Next week there may be a change of timing of the show we made, but I will send an announcement in good time. Everybody will know.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Oh, good night,
everybody. Good night.
Good night, everyone. Take care.
Good night.
Thank you.